Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
Thank you for joining the Empowerment Zone. I am your host, Ramona Houston.
And today we have Dr. Troy Hardin, who has over 25 years of experience working in social service, educational, and community settings. He is originally from Chicago, and his ongoing research interests are in racial equity, community violence and trauma, and traditional and non-traditional interventions within community and organizational settings. As I stated, he's originally from Chicago, but he just recently moved to Texas. He is now a Texan, and he's director of the Race and Ethnic Studies Institute at Texas A&M University, and he's also a professor of practice in sociology. Today, Dr. Hardin is going to talk to us about his experience in Black and Brown leadership development and also racial and social justice, and specifically looking at trauma and social trauma. I'm really excited to have him today because, you know, the times that we're living in, we need practitioners and educators who can really give us some insight on the whole issue of racial and social justice. So welcome, Dr. Hardin. I'm delighted to have you today.
Thank you. Thank you. Really excited to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, Chicagoan, and all your work there and your move to Texas. Just tell us a little bit about yourself and your work.
Sure. First, thank you for having me on. It's really a privilege and an honor. I really also like the way you said Texan, because you put a special emphasis on that. So your roots came out. But it's just really exciting to be here and to be here in Texas, but also the work that we're getting ready to do at Texas A&M in this historical and political moment. This year, as I'm sure you know, everybody can attest to, has been one that has stressed all of us in so many different ways, and has stressed our world, our society, our cities, and certainly our people. And yet, there is a groundswell of possibility that has emerged that I'm excited about and excited about being a part of. I was born in Gary, Indiana, and we moved to Chicago early on. I moved back and forth, actually. My parents had moved from Mississippi to Chicago back in the 40s as part of that great migration period after World War II. And so I feel like I have some roots in both places. In Chicago, most recently, I was the director of a master's in social work program and also a professor in that department at Northeastern Illinois University. But also, too, I had a hand in working with the Latino Policy Forum to develop the Multicultural Leadership Academy, which was a space of African-American and Latino, both emerging and current leaders, to really connect and understand what our shared interests were, but then also how those things might diverge and how we could support and stand in solidarity with each other. I also have been working with the Metropolitan Peace Academy at the with the Metropolitan Peace Initiatives as a part of Communities Partnering for Peace, which really worked to address much of the violence that we've seen in our city and beyond. And then historically, I've just done work around designing different interventions related to trauma, but with a decidedly political and structural lens. I'm also the board president of the Chicago Torture Justice Center, which came out of the work done that the activist community did in Chicago to address the torture that took place by Commander John Burge on Chicago's South Side, where they tortured hundreds of men and women, Black men, mostly Black men and women, into false confessions, where many of them served 20, 30 years in prison behind things that they didn't do. And when it came out that this happened, many of them were released, and we filed a reparations lawsuit against the city, which they honored, that resulted in both social service and support programs for those individuals. Each of those individuals received a compensation package, and we started the center that directly works with people who are impacted by police violence. So that's a little bit about the work to do. I'm also a married father of two, an amazing 12-year-old daughter and 8-year-old son.
Yeah. Wow, you are extremely busy, I see, and really doing some impactful work. There's so many directions we can take this conversation. You know, when you look at Black-Brown relations and your leadership work, as well as your work in Chicago, you know, Chicago has always been top of the news in terms of violence going on there. And then just telling our audience about the whole issues, the whole issue surrounding Black and Brown people being victims of violence in Chicago and your work there in really addressing and helping the community to address that issue, but also being able to get some type of, I don't want to just say compensation, but just get some type of relief and fairness concerning that whole issue. So let's talk about your work with Black-Brown leadership development. And you talked about how your work has helped our communities to see our common issues and work together. What have you found in terms of your work and your leadership training on what the issues we need to address are, and how do we overcome those barriers? What has your leadership work shown you in that effort?
Yeah, thank you. I think we decidedly take a transformational leadership approach rather than just only transactional. And the way we think about those things, transactional leadership includes those aspects of leadership that are what some would consider to be the more pragmatic aspects of how do I develop a strategic plan? You know, how do I set up my board of directors? How do I engage in understanding the finance, which are very important issues. And I think the way we think about it is that both African-American and Latino leaders or Latinx leaders need some support around that. So we do include some of those things, but there's a lot of spaces that folks can access that. And so we try to make sure people are connected in that way. However, transformational leadership really thinks about those issues that we are dealing with in our world, in our society, in our communities, both the unique ways those things are showing up, and ask the question, how are you going to be a part of transforming our communities in a positive way? How are you going to address and advocate for both your respective peoples, but then also really engage in policy change as well. So we expect and really create the space where folks learn from history and then really engage in being effective and impactful community leaders in their cities and beyond, in their city and beyond. So one of the things we really do in that is out of respect for history, we actually start our work at the Field Museum in Chicago, and in part because we believe that it's important that African-American and Latinx leaders understand that they own city resources, right? That the city resources belong to them as taxpayers. We have access. And sometimes those spaces become accessed only in different ways by either white or more wealthy parishioners. And so it's not seen as mine, right? And so we want to make sure that folks understand that they can both dictate, own, utilize, and transform those spaces as well. And so we start there, and we are in a very respectful way in the Maury House, which is a traditional house from New Zealand that was actually transported from New Zealand to Chicago to the Field Museum. And the New Zealand Elders, actually Maury elders, came to Chicago to actually bless the space because there was talk about it being appropriated incorrectly, and really blessed the space for use when people came together across different lines, right? As a way to resolve family conflict, community conflict, and the nation. And so we start there. Thinking about our history, thinking about the ways that we diverge, the ways we come together, and thinking about our ancestors. And so in that way, we become unapologetic about who we come from, and we're able to name it, and folks are able to hear it, that even though you might see me as a great leader, or as someone who does this wonderful community work, understand that it's rooted in my grandmama, right? Mm-hmm. Or mom and them, right? You know, or in my big mama, right? And so so that becomes a big part of our space and our claim to really then move into the transformational work associated with changing community. And so from there, we then engage in a series of other processes and support to really advocate and connect around both, like I said, shared issues. So for example, we have a fair tax issue policy bill in Illinois coming up to really work at addressing some of the historical inequities associated with taxation. And so how does that move into a shared framework, you know, for people of color? We also look at the issue of mass incarceration and understand the historical impact of that, particularly in the African-American community, but also how it manifests and impacts the Latinx community as well, including with the deportation. And so, again, we see where we have linkages when the overall system works to discriminate. I think about that old quote, they're coming for you in the morning, they're coming for me at night, right? Mm-hmm. And so we hope people leave with that understanding and ability to work with each other in solidarity.
It's interesting in that you start this whole building this relationship and this transformative leadership through first beginning with history and identity and embracing the spirit of our ancestors, right? And because a lot of times we don't bring, when we talk about leadership and when we talk about community development and helping community, a lot of times we don't go into the spiritual aspect of it and starting there first and starting with our ancestors to see that we're just continuing their work and that we indeed are a river, as Vincent Harding has stated, that each generation has a responsibility making it better for the next generation. Can you talk a little bit about, you talked about some of the issues you address. Can you talk about some of the conversations or the challenges that come up when people are having this dialogue with each other, these two different communities, African-Americans and Latinx community, because I'm sure you all have conversations. What are the challenges that they discuss? And then also, what are the promises that they see in the future in terms of building this relationship. Now, I want to also clarify that this work is done through the Latino Policy Forum, correct? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I do want to state that because I did, I do want to highlight that their work in Chicago as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So the and the Policy Forum does amazing work in impacting and advocating around a lot of major policy issues, both in the state and city. And so we were very excited to partner. So they had been doing a Latino leadership piece for about 6 or 7 years. And I was approached by Silvia Cruente, the executive director, in thinking about what this a partnership can look like. And particularly after we had a mayoral race where Jesus Chuy Garcia, who was known to the Black community and had done work in with Chicago's first African-American mayor, Harold Washington, and was a strong supporter of Mayor Washington, ran for mayor. So Chuy ran for mayor. And there was a decidedly different voter turnout in the African-American community for Chuy versus for the then incumbent Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who since we can make the case was run out by the Black community after the Laquan McDonald impact particularly. And so when Sylvia saw that and knew that it was this ongoing, seemed to be rift, it seemed to be a growing rumblings in the African-American community about, you know, particularly about the Mexican community in many ways and the immigrant community. And then also knowing that there had been historical anti-racism in the Mexican community or in the Latino community towards African-American and the Black community, that we needed to come together. And so we thought, let's see what would happen if we brought 20, 25 leaders together to begin to talk about these issues in a very real way. And so some of the things that would come up would be the anti-Black racism that many folks experienced growing up, both the impact of that on the Black community, but then also how that impacted some of the leaders in the space, you know, hearing their family members say certain things, seeing things show up at work and not necessarily understanding. And then from the African-American side, you know, just continuously dealing with the impact of the historical and systemic injustice that we had experienced. And so, and then asking the question is, you know, who benefits from white supremacy, right? And who and how many people have played into that game, both knowingly and unknowingly, and challenging each other around that. The assumption in some ways by the Latinx community was that Black folks in Chicago had, you know, really had a lot of power and they were just trying to get some of that power, right? Or at least to share in that space when in the African-American context, it was like, yeah, well, that power is very fragile, right? Because there still is a continued economic and systemic and social challenge in the city. Many of our communities are in dire straits and have continued to be in dire straits. So we mentioned earlier the violence that occurs. The violence its roots start in the poverty and economic and structural injustice that has been going on for 100 years in Chicago. And so we really grapple and dive into some of those issues and then look at how our different peoples are have been resistant to injustice in the past, so we can learn from and learn to model that in a new way. Because often, even if, as we look at the trauma in our different histories, we see, you know, there's a term that is popular, and I'm cool with it, which is resilience, right? Our people are so resilient, right? We get hit in the nose, and then we come back, and we're okay, right? But I think the resistance is what we really try to focus on that, even in the face of oppression, that no people have been accepting, and I'll just accept the beat down and keep moving. No, it's we're going to move and fight for transformation and change. So we really worked to bring out and create the space that spirit can come out, and we can ask the question of how do I stand with you? And there may be times when I need to lead in my own community and do my other work, and will you stand with me in that space? And will you move in solidarity? And will you stand up in the face of anti-blackness in your own community, right? And will you stand up to the face of anti-immigration in your own community, right? So we challenge each other around those things.
Yes, and it's so important. I like the fact that you you prefer the term resistance versus just resilience, because that's what we do, right?
Right.
We also resist. You know, we don't just take it. There's take abuse or oppression or exploitation or what have you. We also
fight back.
Fight.
Yeah, vision forward, right? You know?
I interviewed Sylvia Puente as well for my podcast, and I'm glad you're talking about the work in more detail about the Latino Policy Forum and what you do. When you look at trauma and social trauma, can you expand upon that concept of what you're talking about? Because you kind of lightly touched on it in that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I've been just throughout the years, from a young person, right? Looking and thinking about our history, and also about the different things that, you know, I would see. And particularly when people start talking about, I remember just the late 80s and early 90s. What's that that rap song? Stop the Violence. Gotta stop the violence.
PE, Public Enemy.
Well, not just Public
Enemy. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was a whole bunch of people.
Everybody came together. And there was this thing about, we need to stop black on black violence, right? Which is critical and important. I'm all for that. And that's something, a big part of the work that I do. However, also recognize that, you know, there's some other things rooted in that, you know, that if we look at history, we would see where white supremacy, right, would often lay the foundation for some of those issues that we would see in our communities. And so it really led me to think about how particularly the psychological community often focuses on the interpersonal nature of violence, which again is important, but so often there's these other larger issues that, intercede or support and connect with, whenever we talk about the violence in Chicago, for example, I always go back to 1919, right? And the Red Summer.
Yep.
And the race riot that occurred, you know, after a young man decided to swim in at what's known as our 31st Street Beach and crossed an invisible line in the water, right?
Yes.
And then was attacked by white mobsters and ultimately killed. And then a race riot emerged. But that wasn't just the only race riot that happened in the country, right? There were several that happened throughout the country at the time, right? And so if we look at, the violence that comes out of Chicago, we have to think about Fred Hampton and mm-hmm. what happened with Fred Hampton.
And 21 years
activist,
old.
Yeah, and Mark Clark, you know, who was killed and shot some 90 times by Chicago police who invaded his home, right? We have to look at Martin Luther King, you know, coming to Chicago and marching and saying that the racism in Chicago was worse than some of the stuff he experienced in the South because of the violence that he occurred, that happened for him. And then he saw ultimately the violence in housing and schooling and education that was occurring. And so, and, you know, I often share too that, you know, because people talk about, you know, the rift between policing and community. I say to that again, you know, because of the things like the John Birch and the millions of dollars that have been spent by the city to repair harm, you know, and settle lawsuits, you know, after police have harmed, you know, is that when institutions fail, right, they tear at the fabric, the social fabric of society, and we don't trust the same way. And so people then take issues in their own hands very often. So when I think about trauma and all the work around trauma in the brain and the impact of violence on the body and how, you know, we need to do things to heal, I like to go back and say, well, if we're going to work at healing the individual, we also have to work at healing the community. We also have to work at healing the larger society, right? We also have to heal and repair the harm that has been created by these 400 years of historical injustice. My pastor, actually, Reverend Otis Moss III, says that.
Oh, I didn't know he was your pastor.
Yeah.
He's my classmate. We were SGA presidents together.
Wow. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That it makes sense now, right?
Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt your thought.
No, that's okay. He said, you know, around the time that we started talking about COVID, he said, well, if we're going to deal with COVID-19, we got to deal with COVID-16-19.
Yeah.
Right. And so that, that's the reality, right? Yeah. We got a lot of connections, I see.
Yes, I see. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, this whole part about healing is not just the individual healing, but the community healing, the nation's healing. You know, that's a big part of the process. We can't just blame individuals for the violence, as you have thoroughly explained, that it has to do with the systemic issues that create the violence. I really appreciate that extended conversation. I'm so happy that you have been here today and talking about, you know, racial and so your work in racial and social justice, leadership development, the importance of Black and Brown communities showing up for each other, not just wanting you to show up for me, but I also have to show up for you as well. And also about the whole trauma and social trauma and healing process. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really want to keep going and just having an extended conversation. But if you could, I would really like you to come back at some point in time to expand on some of these issues even more. And also talk about your work in Texas. I know you've only been there for a few weeks, but we're expecting great things from you in Texas and expecting you to make a big impact as you have in Chicago.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. I really appreciate it being on. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have a great one.
All right.
Hello, I'm here with Dr. Troy Harden, and he's going to give us one piece of advice to help students succeed in college. Hi, Dr. Harden.
Hey, how you doing, Ramona?
Fine. Could you tell us what colleges you attended, what your majors were, and what one piece of advice you would give students for college success?
Okay, I attended Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia, Chicago State University, Loyola University Chicago, where I got my master's, and in social work, and then DePaul University, where I got my doctorate in education. In terms of, and then my undergrad major was psychology and sociology. Okay. All right.
You had Dr. Braithwaite then, huh?
In Atlanta?
Yeah, psychology.
Actually, no, because I left, I was an economics major when I was at Morehouse.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So Winstead and Egan.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I actually took Egan on Spelman's campus.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. One thing that I would invite or just advise folks to think about is something that I didn't do as much when I was an undergrad, which is connect with the professors, right? Get to know the professors. Yeah. They have office hours, go see them during their office hours, get involved in different projects that they were involved in. No one told me that that is something that I should do. And so I showed up in class and would just sit and just do my thing. And then as I got closer to graduation, I realized that if I want to get into a graduate program, I'm going to need a recommendation letter from this professor, that often they give wonderful and amazing career advice. They often have networks that extend well beyond the campus and the classroom. And when I realized that, in my graduate program, it really opened my eyes up to how mentoring could really occur, you know, and how other groups have often taken advantage of those kinds of opportunities. So that would be the one thing, is that connect with, you know, your professor, you know, go to the office hours, see if there's other activities and research opportunities on campus that you can get involved in, and expand your network. Your network is going to be very critical. As we say, used to say in Chicago, it's not just who you know, it's not just what you know, and it's not just who you know, it's who sent you.
Yes, that's it. So that is great advice. Make sure that you connect and build relationships with your professors. Your professors are ones who they sit on committees. They're the ones who can write those letters of recommendations. They're the ones who know the opportunities first that you can get to get connected to. So make sure you build relationships with your professors.
And if you got an 89 score,
they might push you over.
It might. Right. So, you
know. All right. That's great advice. Thank you, Dr. Harden.
Thank you, Dr. Houston. Appreciate it.
A special thank you to the incredible team of the Empowerment Zone. Terry Ungully, theme song. NADWORKS, digital support. And of course, our featured guest.
If you enjoyed my podcast, please subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts too. Thank you for your continued support.